You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 388. We're going to be talking about it all. Misfits, dimwits, nitwits, pitwits, and sandwiches. Welcome to Punk News Podcast. Hey, welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is features editor John Gentile. That was not one of my better openings, but, you know, listen, they can't all be winners. They can't all be gems. Sometimes you just got to, you know, put a little bow on the turd and go along with it. Speaking of bows on turds, we are here with managing editor Adam White. Adam White, you've got your big show on Saturday. By the time people hear this, it have already happened, so it's not like we're trying to get people to go out there, though people should go out there. But by the time you hear this, they've already been there. It's already happened, so it won't matter. Anyways, the point is, Adam, how are you feeling? Are you feeling nervous? Are you feeling juiced up? Are you feeling excited? What's going through your mind a mere 48 hours before your big shindig in Toronto? And also, are you worried about that serial killer that was tying people up on his bed in Toronto, too?
You're the second person that's mentioned a Toronto serial killer to me in the past 4 or 5 hours, and both you and my wife each had a completely different MO and description of what this killer does. And both of those things are totally different than the one that I understood was apprehended last week. So there might just be like three of them floating around, which is concerning, I guess. I don't know. I'm not particularly nervous about this because everyone else that's involved in the show is more competent than me, so I just sort of have to like show up and not set myself on fire, and I think that that will be okay so long as I guess like other people show up. I'm hoping.
Okay, well, Adam, I hope it goes. Will you be doing a wrap up article about the event?
I have a pretty big article coming out beforehand, so maybe not a wrap up in that sense, but I have my photographers kind of coming out, so we'll probably do
a wrap up coming. Did you say you have a wrap up coming beforehand?
Yeah, because it's all, I'm just making it up, right? No, I have a piece about the bands and stuff that is coming out before, which is pretty big. My photographer's coming out though, so Steven will be there, so we'll hopefully get a bunch of cool pictures and do something with that afterwards. But I don't know, we'll see. It'll be interesting. This is the one thing that makes this a little more scary and a little less scary for me is that it's not my
serial
town.
Killers.
Well, serial killers. Yeah, serial killers, of course. But it's not my town. So there's a degree of things that are going to happen that I am going to directly blame on the city of Toronto and the people that live there. And I can't control either of those things. So if Toronto fucks up, it's Toronto's fault.
You have a sound curfew?
I don't know. I think like generally stuff in Toronto wraps at like 2, like bar wise, but there's various weird institutions that somehow have licenses to go until 4, but I don't think that's going to be a problem for us, but I don't know. We'll see. Again, if I don't self-immolate myself, then I'm doing pretty good.
Well, that Adam, you know, Philadelphia, 11 o'clock sharp or even 10 o'clock sharp in some parts of town. Oh, woo-wee.
Nothing fucking happens in Toronto until like, you know, at least after 11:30, which is brutal as I get older and due to the fact that I live like 2 hours away. So in a lot of cases, if I'm going to Toronto to see a band, it means I'm not getting out of anything that I'm there at until 2, which means I have a horrible zombie drive back to Niagara.
Well, listen, speaking of horrible zombie drives, we're also here with reviews writer Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, what's happening, man? What's happening down in L.A.? You were at a show like a couple days ago or a day ago or something?
Things have been good. It's been a couple weeks since I've been, at least a few weeks since I've been on last. So it's good to be back. But I guess month, I've been to 3 shows that were spectacular. Last night I saw the Lillingtons and the Last Gang at the Viper Room. I saw, and this will actually, I'll bring this up later. I saw Mean Jeans open for the Shrine about a week and a half ago. And then on the 5th, I saw Hot Water Music and Dead to Me. So I've been plenty busy. But yeah, they were all really, really cool shows. And yes, I know, I don't know if Adam will be happy about this, but yes, Mean Jeans did play a few of their jingles and it was awesome.
I have a different question actually for you. Was Wallard at the Hot Water Music show?
He was not. It was Chris Creswell.
Yeah, okay. He was in Toronto as well. What's going on? I missed the Chris Wallard story here.
He's
sick.
Yeah, he has some. I don't know what the illness was, but we did post the January show I was supposed to go to that I went to was supposed to be in November. And apparently that's when the whole they had to reschedule those two shows. There's one in San Francisco as well. But I got to tell you, even though it was sad Chris Wallard wasn't there, Creswell just killed it. I don't know how he's able to do an hour and a half about worth of Hot Water Music songs and learn them that quickly. And I got to tell you, he sang lead on Trusty Chords, and it was really good.
Huh. I saw the pictures from the Toronto show, but I wasn't sure if that was just like a... So, you know, sometimes bands come to Canada and one of them doesn't get over the border because of, you know, reasons. And and sometimes you have to make do and do strange things. I didn't know he was ill at all. So, all right. Well, hopefully Chris Wallard is on the mend. But there you go.
Well, listen, speaking of being ill in the head, what band has that song Ill in the Head? Oh, that's Suicidal Tendencies, isn't it? Isn't it? Ill in the Head?
I don't know Suicidal Tendencies catalog, John. I'm not going to answer this for you.
Well, I meant to do a Minor Threat reference, but Ill in the Head is not a Minor Threat song. Who does Ill in the Head? Damn. Anyways, I read this book called Straight Edge, a clear-headed hardcore punk history by Tony Rettman, who's written a lot of books lately.
Hold on, Johnny. Stop. I got to cut you off here because you're going to feel really bad. It's Dead Kennedys. Continue.
Shit, even I... Fuck, I should have known that too.
Were you not just gloating about your three-hour Jello interview that you had to transcribe?
Well, I was. I guess, Ill in the Head is it's a release track, but it was only released on Give Me Convenience and also Live at the Death Club. Man, that's a burner. Woo, woo. Anyways, that's actually what this song is about. Speaking of being ill in the head, I got this book. I'm not getting paid to say this or anything, but I just got this book. It's called Straight Edge, a clear-headed hardcore punk history by Tony Rettman, who's written at least two or three other punk oral histories. And I gotta say, it really did give me a better understanding of the straight edge scene. I'm not into straight edge music at all beyond Minor Threat. And Minor Threat doesn't even say they're straight edge. This book's got interviews with Minor Threat, Gorilla Biscuits, Judge, Chain of Strength, Unity, Uniform Choice, Instead, Justice League, all the straight edge bands worth knowing. And I got to say, the book is fantastic. It taught me a lot about straight edge, a lot about all the bands, but also it also reaffirmed to me how kind of asinine the entire movement is. And I hope I'm not making too many enemies with this, but
yeah, there goes a third of our listenership.
As listeners know, all our listeners drink whiskey and love friends. Straight edge hates your friends and not drinking whiskey. I gotta say, man, the only people that come off with like any like individuality or critical thinking at all is Minor Threat, and of course, hilariously, Jeff, Jeff Nelson of Minor Threat and Brian Baker are not straight edge at all, and Ian MacKaye is, but even Ian MacKaye says he doesn't really think it was that great of a movement. But I'm amazed in the book the book is a wonderful I really think most punk should read it just because it's such an interesting book, and that. The Minor Threat guys say we're not really too into it as a religion or even as a philosophy. After them, every single other person in the book basically says, this is my religion, this is my philosophy. But none of them can explain why not drinking and not smoking is an important platform to build a whole line of thought off of, aside from the fact that A, they, quote, you know, weren't accepted by people that drank. But is that enough to build a religion off of? It gets even crazier when about one third of the way through the Boston team gets involved and they're like, you know, we love to play sports, so we didn't feel welcome in the punk scene. Finally, there was some punk for us, for guys that played sports and were tough and handsome and got lots of girls. It's like, yeah, punk's really meant for you guys. Yeah. Yeah. And then it gets even crazier when we get to the hardline section. Do you guys know what hardline is? Or is it hard stance or hard line? I forget. It's one of the two. I think it's hard stance. Do you guys know what that is?
Not encountered. No,
I don't think so.
The main band is Vegan Reich. Another band was a band called Raid, and there's a couple of other bands.
Earth Crisis?
No. Earth Crisis is actually a step back from that. Let me see if I can find it real quick. But basically, here it is right here. Hardline, yeah. Basically, it's straight edge taken to its utmost severity in that they basically would, you know, pull cigarettes out of people's mouths, beat people up, commit direct action, you know, blow up trucks and that kind of a thing, and basically be extremely judgmental, and also they even have a mandate that they follow and like rules, and so it literally is a religion or a set of instructions as opposed to critical thinking, which to me is the exact opposite of punk, what punk rock is, and especially what Minor Threat is. And then the kicker is the main guy becomes a fundamentalist Islam, a follower of Islam, and they ask him, so you're anti-choice, correct? And he says, yes, I'm anti-choice. And they say, well, why? And he just starts quoting scripture. And that blew my mind that he's not doing any critical thinking whatsoever, and he's just quoting fundamentalist religion. And I find that so interesting that punk can go from one side to the complete other side, or a complete 180, if you will. The Krishna core guys and some reactionary Christian guys, they're not quite that severe, but it's not much better for them. And as a case study as to how punk rock can go from one thing and basically do a complete mirror reflection of what it actually is very fascinating to me. And what's more fascinating is, even though the book is about 400 pages, not one of the straight edge guys can really explain as to why being straight edge is important.
Blowing up trucks sounds more like terrorism than a music movement.
Well, it is terrorism, but they say it's terrorism. Like they're proud of that.
Oh, what?
I mean, to be honest, yeah, trucks are horrible, right? Like, woo. Well, we should just get rid of all the trucks. I mean, when I was a kid, I feel like there was a year of my life where I would have maybe nominally called myself straight edge, but it was a complete cop out because I didn't have the opportunity to, you know, like drink, smoke, or have sex or whatever they weren't doing. Like I didn't, like those things weren't happening, and I was pretty young. So it wasn't something that I was going to be exposed to all that much. And I was pretty antisocial, so I wasn't putting myself into the situations where I was experiencing those things. So for a little while, it felt good to nominally call myself straight edge in the sense that, you know, it was just essentially that the way that, you know, the chips had fallen in my young, like preteen life at that point anyways. So, you know, I had my brief little fling with it, but, you know, as soon as I realize that like I could go, you know, drink with my dumb buddies, then that's what we decided to do instead. And I don't think we ever really look back from that. What was appealing to it about it to me at the time was the anti thing. Like when you're young and you feel really alienated by, like, you know, by the popular crowds and by what's going on in pop culture, it makes a lot of sense to, you know, take the fact that, you know, you aren't getting to participate in all of these things and stamp that on as a badge of honor, right? And be like, yeah, I'm not going to all the cool parties and getting drunk with people, but I don't want to because fuck you, right? Like to be able to do that for me as a young kid felt pretty cool for the few months in which I dabbled in this. But yeah, that all went away pretty quick. So I can't really explain why someone would be with someone would latch on to it further than that. And I can't explain is that I could certainly explain why you would choose to not drink or, you know, or not smoke or any of those types of like substance abuse things. Like, I get that. What I don't quite get is putting the label on it. Like, you know, there's plenty of people I know that don't drink, and they don't drink for all sorts of personal reasons. You know, they've had a family history of alcoholism. They don't want to, things like that. But none of them are going and making that a, they're not waving it around like a flag. And that's the disconnect for me, is that I've never been in a place where I've encountered anyone that felt the need to make it like a, make it a marker for them, make it something that they wanted to have as like a core part of their identity. It was just a private choice. And that's where the straight edge as a movement has always sort of fallen apart for me.
Well, and of course the irony is most of the guys stop being straight edge. Like it's an untenable position. You know, it's like the funny thing for me is essentially I'm straight edge in my actions, but not in my philosophy, is that a lot of these guys, like, they're constantly fighting the want to drink or to smoke marijuana or whatever. Like, to me, that's not a desire, you see. So what does it mean if you have to fight yourself for that desire constantly? Like, what's the idea behind that?
It's like, it sounds, you know, like it's like being an AA before you're an alcoholic.
well put, Ricky. But listen, I'm not talking trash. I think this book, it's one of the best punk rock books I've ever read, just because it's so fascinating. Straight Edge by Tony Redmond. I highly recommend it. I think it's very interesting. Do you guys want to read some mail or say that's for next week?
I haven't heard some mail in a while.
All right, maybe we'll do one letter and then we'll move on. Okay, this is from, let's see here, Mander. A band that I love recently put out a record that I do not like. It's not bad, it's just meh, if you know what I mean. I'm trying to lie to myself and get myself to enjoy the record, but it's just not clicking. What do you do when your favorite band puts out a record that is bad or boring, or you just don't like it? When is the last time that happened to you? From Mandor.
If that happens to me, then usually I'll skip it there. I'm not going to name the band, but it did happen to me last year with a certain release that came out. No. Well, no, I didn't hate
Shapeshift with Me.
I didn't hate Shapeshift with Me. I realized it kind of took me a little while to get to fully grasp, but and it was a grower, which is fine. And if that's not the case, there is one album though last year that Shapeshift with Me came out in 2016, but it sucks, but then like maybe a couple months later, you're still just enjoying the rest of the catalog. I think, listen, your favorite bands are not perfect. I think we put our favorite bands as on a pedestal and we can expect like they can't do anything wrong. Well, in reality, they can do wrong because they're not perfect. So I say just be a little bit forgiving and say like, listen, all right, I didn't like this one. I still love them. Whatever they've done in the past has been fantastic. Let's just move forward. That's it. Like, I mean, unless it starts to become like a, you know, release after release starts to go down a road you don't like, then you might have an issue there. But I think you should just kind of be a little bit forgiving because these guys are trying to do something different every record. So
I feel it's rare these days where an album has come out that I have found, you know, offensive, and it's more so that the band becomes boring to me. It's usually not even that they're boring at the point when that record comes out. It's a gradual thing, and then by the time the next one comes out, I'm making the judgment call that like I don't have time for this. There's other things that'll happen. Like in the 90s, I feel like this happened a lot more because you had a lot of bands that had, especially in the punk scene, that had a certain sound had a certain thing going for them, and they would go and they would try to make that leap to the next level because, you know, there was money in it, and there was more drastic reworkings of sounds and jumps and shifts and things like that. The only thing I'm thinking about in my head is H2O, really, because it, like H2O was, you know, they were the skate punk version of a New York hardcore band for a long time, and then when they signed to that major label, they went way far into the pop punk territory. So much so that it wasn't just like the style that they were writing and the production values and all that, but you know, the Toby Morse went, he was taking vocal lessons and working with a coach on that. Like the band pretty significantly changed the way that they sounded. And I don't think feel like that happens too much anymore. At least not that I can, not in any of the bands that I'm running into. For me, it's just more so that, you know, something comes out and I'm a lukewarm fan, and then you know, by the time two or three things later comes out, I'm not going to worry too much about it. And then it's gone. There's a band that we're talking about later on the show that I feel like is a band like that for me.
You know, from most of the bands that I listen to don't put out bad records. Melvins don't put out bad records. Dwarves don't put out bad records. But I guess my next level down bands that I really like a lot, but they're not my very, very favorite, like Ceremony, their last two albums were not that great. Even F'd Up, Glass Boys, I thought it was a little boring, honestly. I even thought David Comes to Life was a little boring, to tell you the truth. But with F'd Up, though, I'd love, like, their Zodiacs. I think their Zodiacs are fantastic. With me, if a record's not that good, you know, don't dwell on it. I mean, enjoy the back catalog. Yeah. A whole lot of other bands out there. And also, like, if a band puts out a bad record and it's because they were trying something different, you can't penalize it because you can't do the same thing over and over and over, you know? So if a band's trying something different, my advice is just to support them and, you know, don't lie and say, oh, I love the record. Say, I think it's really cool you're doing something different, you know, because generally the most interesting bands do different stuff on every release. Sometimes a band will put out a record that you don't dig, you put it aside, you come back to it 3 or 4 years later, and you're like, oh my god, this record is amazing, I just did not get it at the time. Earlier today when I was reading this email originally, I had an idea for what record that was, but now I can't remember. As a side, I was listening to the Rolling Stones' Dirty Work album a couple of days ago. It's really not that bad, to tell you the truth. And you know, sometimes bands just put out bad records. What are you going to do? You know, I mean, it's not the end of the world. You know, they still got the other catalog, and you know, bands that stick it out bounce up and down a lot, and they've got good periods and bad periods, and what can you do about it? You can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. I'm going to play a song real quick, unless someone else had one scheduled. Did somebody else have one scheduled right here? No, so I'm going to play a song real quick. It was Eric Peterson's birthday just a couple of days ago. Eric Peterson was the singer of Mischief Brew. He passed away about a year and a half ago now. I think it's important to keep people in your thoughts and memories, especially people that you admire or are friends with or just generally liked. Eric Peterson was a fantastic musician, so we're going to play one of Mischief Brew's earlier songs. This is the Mischief Brew classic track. This is A Liquor Never Brewed by Mischief Brew off their first full length called Smash the Windows, out on Fistolo Records.
Asking how we got here, and we were tired of slumber, but the glasses never were rinsed. The walls are tapping on my back, it's shredded for man. I think I see a smile through his teeth in his cigar. He put my hands to work and said it otherwise do nothing, and I made a thousand things today I'm sure I'll never use. The walls are ringing up my bell, picked it up to answer. They said they were my comrade, but I couldn't say my name. So I asked about the sun and moon and what the thoughts of time were. They hung it up in madness and went on to punch the clock. They had a Mischief Brew, but no goblets were used. Best of my reporter, 'tis a liquor never brewed. Never brewed. Hey! He questioned me in politics, he scorned my generation for not respecting elders in the land's authority. So when the landlord came to knock, I said, come back tomorrow. It's more like I'll be living there, just slaving for your wage. through the forest for a liquor never brewed. Today I'm following the sound of someone singing. I got an invitation once in Liberty. They had a mission through, but no governments were used. Best of my reporter, tis a liquor never brewed.
Done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And we're back, and that was Mischief Brew. Let's jump into it, boys. Big news, big news, big news this week. The Misfits announced a fifth show, making my proclamation come true, even when I doubted myself. I doubted myself that there was going to be an East Coast show, but lo and behold, there is an East Coast Misfits show. The Misfits with Glenn Danzig, Jerry Only, Doyle, and Dave Lombardo on drums. Opening is Suicidal Tendencies and Murphy's Law, in direct contrast to the West Coast shows, which had more modern or semi-modern bands opening. The New Jersey show has strictly punk rock bands opening. Murphy's Law is, of course, is kind of a funny band. Suicidal Tendencies isn't funny, but they're, you know, crossover thrash punk. It's at New Jersey's Newark Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey, which is a beautiful, beautiful town, Newark, New Jersey. Very wonderful town, wonderful town. Tickets are on sale now. They are not cheap. After fees, they range from $100 to, I think, $500.
Oh.
I said to myself, is it worth it? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? I'll let you guys go and talk about it if you want to talk about anything. And you guys can guess if I did or did not buy a ticket and for how much.
So the LA show, I missed the boat on so hard. Like, the pre-sale basically sold out the entire show. And,
it was crazy, Ricky. Well, never mind. I'll go ahead.
Yeah. And
well, you're right. There's like five tiers of pre-sales. And yeah. So by the time it gets general sale, like, they're all gone. Like, a normal person can't get a ticket.
Exactly. And the other thing was, like, I looked on StubHub, and general admission was by itself was $400. And I said, I can't do this. I can't do it. And I just didn't want to be in the fucking nosebleeds. Like, at that point, it's just going to be, I just be like pointless. If I have to squint to see Doyle play guitar, I'm not going to go and pay $400 for that. I wish I could have seen them. I think it's, I think this is really cool that they're doing this. John, I think you went balls out and you paid the most expensive price because you're a Misfits and Danzig maniac. So that's where I'm. Yeah.
What are the what's the logistics of this show? Are there general admission, like, floor seats these days? Are they seated? Are they arenas? Like, what is this? What's this look like?
The one in LA was an arena.
I'll tell it in terms that Adam White can understand. It's an ice hockey arena. So general admission, which are usually the cheapest tickets, are the most expensive because they're like, you can walk up to the stage. Then there's the lower tier tickets and then the upper tier tickets.
Gotcha. Okay. We just call it hockey here. You don't need to prefix it with ice.
Ricky, you know, we always call ice hockey, don't we? People.
No, I just call it hockey. Unless I see
In Europe, is there a big field hockey movement out in Philadelphia?
Well, I was going to say, like,
Adam. You actually hit the nail on the head, Adam. Field hockey is very big on the East Coast, especially in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland. Very, very big. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, see, it's not here, and I know, like roller hockey out here is at least differentiated. But if someone says hockey in California, I'm assuming it's safe to assume they mean the ice, even though there's like no ice here.
Wow, I derailed this. John, did you pay $500 to go see the Misfits?
No.
Oh, I assume you're going, though.
Yeah, indeed. I looked, honestly, I was thinking maybe I'll get like a medium ticket, but medium tickets were 160 plus fees, which is like $210. And I'm like, you know what? I really, really, really want to go, but I remind you when I saw the Rolling Stones in 2012, I think it was the Rolling Stones. It was an arena show, and the cheapest tickets were like $275, which was insane. However, people were complaining so much they issued like special like discount tickets for $75. But the kicker was that there's only like 100 of them at like a 12,000 seat, you know. So I logged in, I tried to buy those. I couldn't buy them. I'm like, well, I guess I'll just get a $275 ticket because the Stones are my favorite band. I clicked buy, and as soon as I clicked buy, I felt like such a jackass. I'm like, am I so desperate to see Mick Jagger for 120 minutes that I'm going to spend $350 to see him? Am I that pathetic of a person? But then after I clicked buy, someone else bought the tickets I was going to try to buy. So I'm like, I had, even though I wasn't going to see them, I had a sense of relief come over me. Like, I'm like, you know what? I felt really stupid about paying $350 for a ticket, and it just no band is worth that. And then, luckily enough, I tried to get the $75 tickets again, and I got them, and the $75 tickets were better than the $350 tickets, which blew my mind. That will not happen for the Misfits. So with the Misfits, I just said to myself, you know what? 5 years from now, I won't miss the $100, and I will have at least seen the Misfits. I will have heard the Misfits. So I'll get the $100 tickets in the nosebleed. I'll be content with that. I'll be happy with that. It'll have the jumbo screen. I'll be able to see them. I'll be able to hear them because, you know, arena shows sound like shit, so it doesn't matter where you're at, you know, and I'll be content with that. So I am going to see the Misfits. I got the nosebleeds. No band is worth $500. No band is worth $300. Yeah. You know, like, it's just not worth it, you know. And the point being is if I spend $500 on the Misfits, you know, at the end of the month, I'm going to miss that $500. $100 I can write off. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know what? And if I spent $500 or even $300 or even $250, I want to enjoy myself because the whole time I'm there, I'm like, I spent $250 on this. You know, $100, you know, it's not great seats, but at least I'll get to see them. So I'm excited. I don't mind that Danzig and that Glenn and Jerry are making money off. They're entitled to the money. They really didn't make that much money. They missed it the first time around. I'm glad they're making lots of money. Side note, is Jerry Only maybe one of the reasons why they're making so much money on this? Jerry Only, to a degree, did keep the name alive. Danzig tried to kill it and wouldn't talk about the Misfits for the longest time. So, to a degree, maybe Jerry Only is the guy that made this viable of a tour. But along those lines is, I think they should get paid. I think they're gouging a little bit. I think the top ticket should be maybe 200, and like nosebleed should be like 40 or 50. You know, like $50, I think that is very fair for the Misfits. 60 is very fair. Starting at 100, going up to 500, a little bit of a gouge. I think they're entitled to money. I'm a little bummed out about how expensive tickets are. And the other thing I'm bummed out about is people literally aren't going to this because they can't afford to go. Like Misfits maniacs. Anybody can go to a – like even if you don't have a great job at all or whatever, like if you really want to go to a $40 or $50 show, you can make that happen. You know what I mean? Like you can, you know, bag your lunch every day. You know, you can make a little bit – if you want to go to a $50 show, you can go. But like, man, it's when true diehard fans can't afford to go, that's kind of a scary thing, and not scary in the fun Misfits way, scary in the dread-inducing way. And so I don't approve of that, but you know, I gotta say I've got mixed emotions, but I'm glad I'm going. I'm glad I'll get to see it because I would regret not going if I didn't go.
Two questions. One, how do you think Dave Lombardo pulling double duty at this show will affect the overall Misfits performance? And two, do you think we will get a live album out of this?
First answer, not at all. Dave Lombardo is a pro, and not only is he a pro, he's not too much of a pro. Dave Lombardo is a very raw drummer, and he's probably the best metal drummer there is, if you ask me. So it's not like he's going to run out of energy. He's Dave Lombardo. He's still relatively young. He's only like 55. So I mean, Dave Lombardo's the man. He'll be able to knock us out of the park. There have been cameras at all the shows. A lot of people are getting excited for a live album. A lot of people are getting excited for a DVD. I don't want a DVD, or I want a DVD and a CD combo. I don't want just a DVD, but I don't think that's going to happen because honestly, like media doesn't like the Misfits will make 10 times amount of money from one show that they will from some media. Danzig, to his credit, is notoriously picky about material, like Prince. So I'm sure they're recording a whole bunch of stuff. People are getting excited, but I don't think it's going to come out. If anything, because arena shows sound like garbage, and there's no way not to make them sound like garbage. So I wouldn't get my hopes up about a live out. I'd love a live album. I think that'd be. I'd love a live flag album, but I just don't think it's going to happen.
Okay.
In my head, I wouldn't regret.
That's a minor threat song. Or in my eyes,
you're just batting a. Anyways, 100 isn't something that I think is an amount that's going to cause regret, right? Because like to me, it's and this is going to be the most like privileged like middle class thing ever that I'm going to say, like you know, you can blow $100 on something that's far less memorable and experienced and getting to see the Misfits, right? Like you take your special somebody out for a nice dinner and you've spent $100, right? So
true.
So from that standpoint, okay. So we didn't go out for a nice dinner. We ate a hot dog in the parking lot and then we went to see the Misfits. You know, you still went and had a memorable evening. So that's okay. 500. Yeah, that's pretty. I don't know if I would be able to detach myself from the ticket price while I'm there. Like, I don't know if I'd be sitting there going like, well, that song was $40. Okay. Right. Like that. I don't know if, I don't think I could do that. But yeah, 100, whatever. But you made a really good point though, is that like the Misfits, or yeah, 2 points I wanted to just draw on here. One, I think that Jerry totally deserves some credit in how these shows are going right now. If for no other reason, then it's part of the narrative now, right? Like the contentious, you know, Jerry out on his own years without having all of that like potential conflict in the background and all of, you know, Jerry doing it and Glenn not wanting to have anything to do with it, without years and years, decades of that tension. The fact that they got back together would not have been as big a deal, or it wouldn't have the same resonance as it did. So, you know, I don't know if you could necessarily say that like everything that Jerry Only was doing was particularly virtuous or artistically interesting, but the fact that he was out there doing it, like you can't subtract that from where the band is right now. So, you know, I'm going to give him that. But you are very right that the biggest issue here to me is people that are, you know, diehard fans that aren't going to be able to afford something like this, are going to be priced out of it. And that's always tough, because what do you do if you're the band, right? You could lower the prices, but you're just going to sell out the show just that much quicker. And then do you just schedule more shows? Do you do them until you've, you know, sated the demand? Well, if you just start playing all the time, then you've lost the mystique of it being like a, you know, a limited run reunion thing. So there's some sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't that comes into this. So, you know, it is what it is. I'm not gonna complain too much about it myself. That said, I'm sure the tickets are sold out at this point anyways, but I'm not paying that much to go see the Misfits.
Adam, is there any band you would pay $500 to go see?
I can't. I would spend it. To me, it's about like a perceived value thing. I could totally see myself spending $500 if I was gonna, you know, I'm gonna travel to some music festival and my favorite band in the universe and some other of my favorite bands in the universe are playing this music festival. And I'm sure if, you know, if I've done that kind of thing, if I add up all the little expenses, yeah, maybe it's $500 if I had to go like travel somewhere and get hotel rooms and then go.
That's like a weekend though.
Yeah, right. That's so, like a weekend. I mean, so from the one standpoint, I'm like, you know, maybe I've spent that much to go to a thing, but oh God, single show. I don't know. I can't, like my go-to answer to this would be like somehow like the resurrected zombie Clash. But yeah, even then, $500 is a lot of money, man.
Man, why did we go to Riot? We could have went to Riot Fest and saw Ween and Leftover Crack and Morrissey for less than this. Anyways, moving. We can't.
That puts it in perspective.
Mixed emotions. Listen, a long time Ricky and a long time Adam favorite band are putting out a greatest hit set along with some rarities. Lawrence Arms are putting out a new release called We Are the Champions of the World, of course referencing Freddie Mercury. It's going to be out March 30th via Fat Records. The band is also going on a fairly extensive tour. It's mostly picks from their albums. I don't know if there's any single or EP cuts here you two can explain on that, but most notably, it's got 5 unreleased tracks from their probably most famous album. What's that album called? A Guided Tour. Oh, Calcutta. Is that the most popular album?
I'd say so. I mean, I know people like Apathy as well, but I know there's like kind of like the debate between those two, but I think Oh Calcutta is like their most famous one.
Well, it's coming out. Ricky, are you excited?
I am beyond excited. I did not. This was a very pleasant surprise. I didn't expect this. I think the fact I wouldn't be as excited. I'd be like 1% less excited about this if the bonus tracks were not from Oh Calcutta. But still, I would have jumped on this pre-order anyway. I mean, this is a really good collection. If you don't really know where to start with this band, I gotta tell you, this might be the way to start with them if you haven't really listened to them before. The tour though looked as a great lineup too. I will be going to the LA one. I actually just got my pre-sale ticket today, so I am stoked for that. Red City Radio, Sincere Engineer, the new Red Scare Industries signing. I couldn't ask for more. I love this band. I've only seen them twice, but I saw them at Punk Rock Bowling last year. They were so fucking good. I mean, they were one of my favorite performances, and they were one of the they were the headliners at the one of the club shows. And they were awesome. So I'm also hoping that this means that they're going to be writing new stuff too at some point in the future. No complaints here for me. I'm totally stoked about this.
I'm never sure why people are so excited about a greatest hits collection of songs that they can otherwise hear. So
typically I'm not, like, I'm just saying
that part of it doesn't do a whole hell of a lot for me. I mean, there being five new songs on this, like, that's cool. But to me, I'm sort of approaching this with the same excitement as if there was like an EP coming out, right? Because, hey, true. Five new songs, that's cool. Everything else on here, I've heard a lot. So, you know, I'm not going to be. That's not getting me all bothered about the fact that it's coming out. That said, though, I was looking through the track list on here, and it occurred to me that man, there were a lot of Lawrence Arms songs that at a certain point in my life meant a lot to me. And just like seeing their names on here, some of them make me very happy. And the one that like sort of sticks out to me as being like a pretty important song in the Adam pantheon of life. That made no sense. But the in the overall timeline of me, the song Quincentuple Your Money, which for me was a song that I first heard on like the Plea for Peace Take Action compilation that Hopeless put out in like 2001, and came from a split that they did with the Chinkies back then. That song at like to this day, I think is an amazing song. And it was such like a gateway song to really get into all of that Chicago family of bands, where I had no particular fluency or anything with it. And to tell you the truth, when I was like I remember in 2001 and I heard that song and hearing like Brendan's kind of gritty vocals, I was like, the thing that occurred to me as my closest point of reference was like Rancid, because I'm like, oh, okay, here's some other song by someone that, you know, has a voice that sounds like gravelly shit, and for some reason I enjoy it, right? And that was important to me. So seeing that on this track list is pretty cool. One of the best shows that I ever saw was a Lawrence Arms show. They did a secret show at Pooza the one year, like came on at 1 a.m. in this venue that was, you know, otherwise just doing they were doing like solo stuff, like a lot of John's Whiskey and Friendship stuff was going on in there. But there are a lot of people in there doing kind of like solo acoustic sets. And like, I think that oh, did Austin Lucas play in there? But like he may have. And I think that like Brendan did he may have done a solo set in there, or that, or there was a Sundowner solo set. I forget which, but one of them did one of their solo acts in there. And then like everyone just kind of like hung around in this upstairs venue in Montreal, because, you know, word was getting around that was one of the secret shows. And this whole show, me and former Punk News editor Kira were at the front, like mushed into the stage with like X hundred people behind us. Just like I've never felt as crushed at a show as this one, but like we were like right there up in it. And it was pretty spectacular for that reason. So yeah, I have a lot of goodwill towards the Lawrence Arms. This tour doesn't come near me and Greatest Hits make me shrug. So, you know, but hey, if you need an introduction, this is a good way to do it. John, can I get you a Lawrence Arms record that can be your introduction to the Lawrence Arms?
You can buy it for me, but I mean,
you can get on the trolley, John.
The older I get, I have grown a certain, when I was younger, I loved Greatest Hits because that was before the internet and everything. So like Tom Petty's Greatest Hits was like huge and like, well, not huge, but I enjoyed it a great deal. You know, I'm trying to think of some other Greatest Hits. You know, you got all the best songs for one price. Then when I started to get into albums and really start listening to music, I didn't like Greatest Hits because they often feel uneven and kind of pointless. Now I've come back around again, like the guys in Vegan Reich, and I'm a fan of Greatest Hits to a certain degree. That is, I'm a big fan of Mick Jagger's Greatest Hits and Stevie Nicks' Greatest Hits and some other bands' Greatest Hits, because these artists they've got a few hits from their records, but they've got a whole bunch of other tracks, obscure tracks that are amazing songs that are scattered throughout their history that really are kind of forgotten or just off by themselves. And then when you put these unique or obscure or less known tracks together along with the mega hits, it kind of not only tells a story, but you gain an appreciation for these wrongly forgotten songs, and you realize, wow, this artist is really a fantastic artist. So it's a Greatest Hits culling from maybe lesser known tracks not on albums in order to, I guess, really make the argument as to why the artist is great that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. So I'm a fan of that kind of
that probably makes a lot of sense in the case of one of those artists, because now I don't know his catalog off the top of my head or anything like that, especially solo, but like I have to imagine that there are a dozen of questionable quality later day Mick Jagger solo pieces, and from those you could totally do what you're saying and like, you know, cull out the diamonds that are in between, like the, you know, the ill-fated hip-hop experiments and things like that.
Indeed. And not only that, though, is like he's got one-off singles and collaborations that when pulled into this Greatest Hits context really make everything shine brighter.
What if it's just like Dancing in the Streets 12 times?
The other thing I wanted just to say is I think what's good about this kind of best of album is that it's either like we said, it's either a good introduction if you've never heard the band, or it's for the mega fan that wants something really, a really nice physical piece. And I have a feeling that they're going to do a really good job on this. It's a double LP. I think the who knows what the liner notes are going to have in it. Probably the inside art's going to be great. But if for people that are kind of like either just moderate fans or just kind of meh on them, I can understand like this won't be something that they'll probably go out and buy. For super fans like me, I'm all about this. So I think this kind of lends more to the extremes than anything else. And that probably goes for any other artist too.
Speaking of things someone went out and people go out and buy, a distributor just bought Boots Riley's new film, Sorry to Bother You. In case you don't know, Boots Riley is an MC. He's been part of the coup for over 20 – well, he is the coup for over 20 years now. A few years ago – actually, in 2012, he put out a soundtrack called Sorry to Bother You. It was a coup album. And the idea was it was a soundtrack to his screenplay called Sorry to Bother You. McSweeney's actually published the script, and it did seem like this was going to be one of those passion projects that no one ever really picked up, that never really got made, that would forever haunt an artist and say, if only. Well, the good guys won. Boots Riley actually got his film funded, and he filmed it. It's got some pretty heavy hitter actors in it. It's got Keith Stanfield. It's got Danny Glover. It's got the Old Spice guy. I forget his name off the top of my head. It's got a lot of relatively well-known actors and good actors. The film basically is Lakeith Stanfield is a telemarketer, and he's very bad at it. And then Danny Glover tells him, you have to speak like a white person. So he starts speaking like a white person, which quite hilariously is overdubbed by David Cross. And then all of a sudden he starts making tons of money. Because he's making so much money, management brings him up to the executive level, and he finds himself on the other side of the fence that he used to be on the other side. From there, the film becomes a magical exploration, and it just goes apeshit crazy. And if you want to talk about a film written for John Gentile, it's a movie written by Butch Riley with magical realism and time warping and a bunch of weird, crazy stuff. I am very excited for this film. The important thing is it debuted at Sundance, got rave reviews, and it was purchased for not five, not six, but seven figures by, let's see here, Annapurna, who put out Zero Dark Thirty, American Hustle, and Phantom Thread, which of course is expected to win or did win a bunch of Oscars this year. So this movie is like a for real deal movie. Not only is it a for real deal movie, it's going to be distributed by a like the heavy hitter, I guess what you would call auteur film distribution company. This is the good guys winning, if you ask me. I'm excited. Adam White, does this hold your interest at all?
I will totally watch it. I don't have any context for it outside of the fact that you are very excited about it and I enjoy magical realism. So, you know, I'll take your recommendation, John.
To be fair, how cool is that? Like, Boots has been working on this for like 10 years. And honestly, like in movies, I think if you don't get it moving along pretty quickly, like at the independent level, it ain't happening. You know what I mean? Like at the major label thing, things can hang out in limbo for a long time. But if you're somebody with no connections or, you know, no real connections, if it doesn't happen, like soon, it doesn't happen. But this is a guy that was dogged, determined, had a vision. And it turned out this is one of the good guys winning, if you ask me. This is great.
Well, I mean, Ricky can answer that because you're from LA, so you have like five scripts in the glove box of your car at all times, right?
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, I mean, on Facebook, I get, you know, random people telling me to listen to their band, and then when I'm working, I just get mailed these. You know, I just can't believe I passed up Zero Dark Thirty, and this guy took it from me. I didn't know David Cross was going to be in this, so that definitely piqued my interest. So I might check this out. The other thing is, Boots, after this is done and you're the big movie mogul, let's bring back Street Sweeper Social Club. Okay.
I don't think that's happening, Ricky. I don't think his least interesting project is going to become Roaring Back.
One can dream, John. One can dream.
Ouch. Okay.
Street Sweeper Social Club was awesome. Okay.
Ricky, you need to listen to The Coup. If you thought Street Sweeper Social
Club, I have listened to The Coup, and again, hashtag still don't like hip hop, but The Coup I always did enjoy every once in a while.
So weird. Adam, go ahead, was that Adam?
No, it's a Ricky song. Ricky, play a song here.
All right. So like I said in the beginning of the podcast, I went to a few awesome shows in January. One of which was seeing Mean Jeans open for The Shrine. But there's a band that went on before Mean Jeans that have been around for a while, I guess, but they just became on my radar at that show. They put on a really, really good performance, and they're sort of in that Mean Jeans subgenre, kind of like definitely like heavy on the power chords and stuff like that. I think, but also like melodic vocals and all that stuff. But these guys, I think, are a little bit more on the indie alternative side of that. They're called Dirty Fences. They're out of New York. And their performance was fantastic. So I'm gonna play a song off their album Full Tramp, which came out in 2015. This song is called Judy Don't Go by Dirty Fences. Here it is.
Run back to your home.
Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. That was Dirty Fences, Ricky playing some tracks. We're going long tonight. We got a lot more to cover. We'll get through as much of it as we can. A lot of interesting stuff this week. An interesting news item came out this week in regards to Coachella. As people might know, Coachella is the annual West Coast giant concert performer, which grew out of Golden Voice. And of course, Adam White, who is Golden Voice?
John, I don't know this answer.
Golden Voice was the first big West Coast punk rock promotions company. Actually, they started small. They promoted like some of the very first Black Flag shows, Circle Jerks, Red Cross, Descendants, Dead Kennedys, Avengers. Golden Voice promoted all of these shows, and now they're Coachella, of course. Well, but that was a guy called Gary Tovar. This is not this guy. The guy that owns half of Coachella and half of Golden Voice, his name is Philip Anschultz, and he's under fire right now. The reason he's under fire is because it turned out last year he donated $325,000 to organizations that have an explicit anti-LGBTA message, including Dare to Share Ministries, Young Life, The Navigators, Center for Urban Renewal and Education, and the strangely named Movie Guide Awards. The CEO of Dare to Share, for instance, once blogged that homosexuality is a satanic perversion of God's gift of sex. And of course, people said to him, "Phil, that's lame. You shouldn't do that." And of course, he said, "Oh, well, I didn't know that they had an anti-gay message. I'm not anti-gay at all." However, just last year, he came under fire because he gave $190,000 to anti-gay groups in 2010 to 2013. So right now, it's unclear if he gave his additional money after he came under fire or before he came under fire. The importance being that if he did it after, he was clearly lying and is anti-LGBTA. If it was before, he's either anti-LGBTA or he's not anti-LGBTA. He just doesn't know where his money is going. So it's one of the two. One question is this going to hurt him or Coachella? I think the answer is resoundingly no. I just don't think your average concert goer gives a crap about this at all. Second is, in the age of internet connectivity, are CEOs under greater scrutiny, and is that a good thing? Adam White.
I mean, they are, and it is. It really is going to depend, I think. I don't know if it's going to have too much of an impact with the general concert goer going to it, because people are pretty used to, rationalizing away the things that they find unsavory when they're associated with something that gives them pleasure, right? And people do that every day in small ways, right? Like, we're not going to worry too much about, the fact that, Shell fucking destroyed some village because, oh, hey, you need gas for your car and there's a Shell station, right?
Like, people not make me, those kind of equations. I go to Wawa.
Okay, yes. Everyone that runs Wawa is a fucking saint, I'm sure. Although Wawa is wonderful, John.
It is.
I don't know what you two are talking about.
So when we were at the Punk News Summer Soiree, we finished the show and we drove from where we were in Philly to another place. I'm trying not to triangulate John's location.
To my house.
It is local to Philly. And we're like, hey, we've run this whole show and we forgot to eat. So we should go find some food at 2 or 3 in the morning or whatever it was. Or no, it was earlier than that because you have your fucking crazy curfews.
It was about 1 a.m.
Yeah. So he's like, have you ever been to a Wawa? And I'm like, no, I don't even know what that is. And he's like, well, it is the thing. If you're going to be in Pennsylvania, you have to go to a Wawa and experience this. And I just saw someone talk about it the other day on the internet, and they referred to it as like if a 7-Eleven got its shit together and went to college.
Yes.
That's how it was described, where you walked in there and there was like a counter and there were people making sandwiches and hot food and things like that. And you ordered them off a little iPad and it was great. It was like, if you needed to go get some food at 1 in the morning, usually you have some horrible options, but this was like, you can go in here and someone will make you a fucking sandwich. Like a person will make you a sandwich and it's not, covered in grease or fried or horrible or anything like that. And so John and I went in there and we got some food and then we went out in the parking lot and we ate it on top of a garbage can, because that's what John said you're supposed to do.
That's fancy.
In a
guys.
Wawa fancy. At 1 a.m. So, anyways, yeah, but going back to what I was saying, people are used to compartmentalizing this stuff. So I don't know if your average concert goer is going to go through and extend all the way to the CEO and do that. And, but where I think this could hurt them is in securing acts, right? If, you know, let's assume that your average musician is a fairly socially conscious person that is on the lefty end of the LGBTA rights issue. Well, you know, if you're going to try to pitch them on Coachella, they may either, you know, use this as a reason to not play it and then make a stink, which is what you don't want, or they could use this as a leverage to get more money. You know, if they're going to risk their reputation by coming out and associating with you, you know, they want another zero on this contract. So, you know, there could be repercussions there that crop up, but, you know, I don't know. It's like there's... I'm not going to jump into the other example I have of this because it's super not relevant. But people will all the time make the kind of equations where they're not going to do this. So I think it could hurt them with the artists, though, but maybe not the fans.
Yeah. The other thing is, I don't understand, because he says, like, he didn't know. I don't know whether to believe him or not. I just don't. I'm not trying to take shots at anyone here. But if he did know, I mean, still, like, even if this won't affect attendance, like we're assuming, it's still bad. I mean, this is probably a broader point than to what Adam was saying. It's just bad business to at least be openly discriminatory. I mean, because I can't imagine I can't imagine that at Coachella it just says straight people only. This doesn't seem totally clear to me yet. Even if he has his reservations, even if he has his preconceived notions about LGBT people, being this open about it doesn't make business sense at all.
Yeah, I like to think that when you see a story like this, it's less about, you know, the rich being secretly evil and more about them being fucking dummies who happen to be rich, and they're making like stupid decisions from a business standpoint, let alone from like a being a good person standpoint. And it destroys the whole myth that, like, oh, the, you know, this person is a rich CEO, they must be, you know, really good at business. And it's like, no, there's probably other reasons why they ended up in that station in life, and they happen to be a big fucking dummy. So I don't know. I like seeing people exposed.
Adam, I agree with that, and I want to have an extended conversation on that topic. Not tonight, because we got a lot to talk about, but you and I should have an extended conversation on the podcast about that topic, because I believe I have some insight. Though, imagine being so rich that you don't know where your $400,000 donation is going. Imagine being that.
Well, I see that I don't think is about being rich. I think there are times, and I've read stories about this too, where
able to give away $400,000 isn't about being rich. I think
I'm not done talking. Let me just finish what I was going to say. I don't think it's about the money. I think it's what we haven't heard here is how transparent the organizations are about where the money goes and what they do with it. Sometimes charities, whether that you think they're good or go to another cause you don't agree with, sometimes they're just really vague and they don't really tell you what their money goes to. And some are very transparent. There's actually a whole, I forgot what the website's called, but there's a whole website dedicated to the transparency of nonprofits and grading them. So that's one part. Yeah. So that's why I don't want to say completely it could be stupidity or he's so rich, he just doesn't care. It's also, you don't know what it is from the side of the organizations and what they're doing with the money.
I'm saying though, even if it's his underlings doing it, even if the organization is being shady, if it's your money, it's your fault. You know, the CEOs love to
research. Yeah.
CEOs love to get the credit and say, oh, this business is doing well, or, oh, because I'm so smart, I get $400 million a year or whatever, you know, but they're never like, oh, like, but the trade-off is that if something goes wrong, it's your fault because you are the guy where the buck stops. CEOs, especially in modern contexts, love to say, oh, it's not my fault, it's somebody else's fault. So they want all the benefit and not the, anyways, John's anti-CEO and anti-straight edge. Speaking of guys that are anti-CEO and anti-straight edge, the Gaslight Anthem, they're doing a bunch of 59 Sound 10-year anniversary shows. I won't be there. Ricky, will you?
I won't be able to be there because all of them are, the closest one to me is Chicago. So there's clearly a certain segment of our readership, and I think just the punk scene in general, that are going to flip out about this, because I remember when this album came out, it was massive, and I tried listening to it, and I couldn't do anything with it. I don't know.
There are two punk news staffers thanked in the liner notes, to my knowledge, in this record. At
really?
Least. Yeah, ooh. Two. Ben Connolly and Chris Moran. So wow. there was a time where the Gaslight Anthem were the toast of the punk news town, and I don't know if they necessarily did anything to blow that outside of the fact that it was just like, you know, whoever was on staff at that time was really into that band, and that's not the case right now. But, you know, I don't wish them any ill will or anything like that. People in my circles who I have not seen in a music conversation in like 2 years all cropped up on Facebook in the past few days to go bananas over this. So there are people that are really, really stoked. I saw the Gaslight Anthem in Toronto at around the time when the 59 Sound came out. I think they were up there. They toured the Menzingers at the time. And, oh, John, that was just a show for you, eh? and, you know, people were at that time still really, really, really into them. So, you know.
Yeah, I saw them when that Upside Down Heart album came out, and that was with Against Me. I didn't see it. I kind of got bored, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, it's not really my particular thing, but hey, they seem like nice guys.
Sure.
I'm cool.
Yeah.
They can do their thing.
I agree. They sound like nice guys. I wish them the best. It won't be getting my money, but people want to go and have fun. Good on him, I say. But listen, some a place where I will go and have fun, Andrew WK, he's announced a fairly extensive tour, and he's released a new music video. The music video is for his track Ever Again, and it's off the album You're Not Alone. That's out March 2nd. It follows squarely in the modern Andrew WK template that we've seen before. It's loud, bombastic. It's got a little bit of 80s rock to it, and I saw him described as the new punk rock Meatloaf, and I have to say, I think that's dead on, and I approve.
Punk rock Meatloaf. Huh.
You know what? It's funny because I've heard the Meatloaf comparison used for Sam Coffey in the Iron Lungs, and there's definitely a big overstuffed, but gloriously so 80s rock thing that both of those bands embrace. So, you know, it kind of works there. The I'm not sure about this song though.
Too much production, not enough song.
Too much production, not enough song. There is there's a vocal effect that they're using on his vocals in here that, I mean, it may just be like pretty extensive multi-tracking, but like it leans pretty close to something that feels like it's like it's a hair away from there being some like bad modern day hip hop auto tune going on there. And I don't know, it's not completely overt, like it skirts around it, but it gets close at times. And I'm not so sure if I'm into that. Like, I enjoy the bombast of this. The video is kind of amusing in that at the end he just starts to glow and like fire light and power out of his body. I don't know. There's a little bit of a vocal thing in here that I'm not quite sure sits too well with me. Slash, this song could totally be about fucking Jesus, man. It's like if take the lyrics of this song, right? And like, you know that whatever you know, transcendent cosmic force that he's singing about that has given him salvation is partying because it's Andrew WK. But he doesn't actually really say that in the song. And you could take this song and like plop it into any, you know, Christian music festival and everyone would be down with it because they know what he's talking about. He's talking about the Lord, John. So there's a little bit of a weird that I get out of here, but I might just be hypersensitive about those things.
Do you think Andrew WK, of course, his persona is that he's weird, and you read a little bit about him and he comes off as really weird. Do you think he is really, really a strange person, or is it mostly an act?
See, when I saw him, and this was probably I hadn't laughed during a show so hard, like probably all year. When I saw him, he, right before they played Party Hard, they counted not from 10, not from 30, they counted from 90 all the way down to 1 to count it off. And it was hilarious, but it was also really weird. And so I think it's definitely exaggerated. I've seen him in interviews where he kind of comes off as pretty, like a pretty normal guy. Regarding what Adam said, I think most of the criticisms he said were fair. I didn't get the Jesus thing out of it, though. Overall, though, I'm definitely looking forward to this. I have not jumped on the pre-order bandwagon yet, but I'm looking forward to this. You're no complaints here overall, but I think what Adam said about the music was fair.
I'm looking forward to the full band live show. I still haven't seen him in full band aside from Marky Ramone, so it should be very exciting.
Him play, like, he played like 3 songs at the last show that I saw him at with someone on his shoulders that he plucked out of the crowd and just didn't put them down and just kept playing. I went to a Catholic school, so I sort of look for secret Jesus and everything. So that might just be what I'm getting out of this, but that's
a Depeche Mode song, your own secret Jesus.
Speaking of secret Jesus, Dead to Me is back. They have a new video for their new single, which is called Fear is the New Bliss. The track is, going to be officially released on February 2nd, which is tomorrow, which is going to be after, you know, in the past for anyone that's listening to this podcast, so you can go get it. Well, the band's currently working on their new album. It's called American Son of Cholo. It is going to follow up the I Want to Die in Los Angeles 7-inch that they put out in 2016. So you can go check out this video. John, what were you going to say there?
Oh, about this?
No, you sound like you were about to chime
in. Oh, no, that was me. I thought you said the record was going to be out on February 2nd, but it's not. There's no release date yet. The single's going to be out on the 2nd.
Single's going to be out on the 2nd. So, Ricky, this is your thing. Yes, how does it feel to see Jack and Chicken together singing in a video?
I got to tell you, it's the whole thing. This might be my favorite story of the year. I don't know. I mean, I think they played this song because they said they did play a new song when I saw them earlier in January, so they might have played this. This is fantastic. I love this. And someone in the comments said, you know, and I've seen other people say this, like, it's just pure magic to see those two sing together, because Jack has a much, you know, kind of like a softer tone to, and more melodic, but then you got, you know, Chicken's angry vocals in there. This was fantastic. As far as videos go, it's fine. I mean, I think it's kind of just like a pretty straightforward video, which is fine. But the song, I think, was fucking fantastic. I'm trying to listen to it as much as I can before I see them again on the 17th. Because this is one of the few bands where I need to be in front and yell all the words to all the songs when they're playing. So I could not be more stoked. I hope we can get American Son of Cholo out this year. Like I said in my end of the year review of 2017, it's my hands down my most anticipated record. I could not be more stoked about this. Listen to the song if you haven't. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I enjoyed this. For some reason in this, like, Jack did not immediately sound like Jack to me. I don't know if there's something a little bit different about either the way that he is singing or the way that it's produced or anything like that. Because that guy has a super distinctive voice, but it didn't... Until I, like, looked at the video, I'm like, oh, shit, yeah, there he is. What am I... Why am I not hearing Jack? But, you know, whatever. I like Jack.
Everyone, more stuff. It's hard to not like Jack. Even in the comments, everyone's like, Jack... It's more than just one person. Everyone keeps saying Jack can do no wrong. Jack can do no wrong. Jack is always amazing. So, yeah. So, John, this isn't Whiskey and Friendship. What do you got to say?
Do you guys want to get into it or not really?
I'm open to hearing different points of
view. I don't want you to break poor Ricky. He's had a rough week.
Let's talk about Roy Orbison.
Aww. Now I'm broken.
John, why does this keep happening?
Easy answer. Money, 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 money. Listen, Roy Orbison, he's back from the dead. He's following in the wake of Holo Tupac, Holo Easy, Holo Frank, and Holo Dio. A hologram of Roy Orbison will be touring in the UK. It's called In Dreams, Roy Orbison in Concert, even though he's not in concert at all. And he's going to be backed by like a full orchestra. If you go to punknews.org, you can see him, quote, performing Pretty Woman in front of the orchestra. Most disappointing, well, two disappointing things to me. Well, this is all disappointing to me, but one of the main disappointing things to me is they didn't even take a live recording for his vocal track. They just took the studio track of Pretty Woman, which is bizarre. Second, and I didn't notice this, but a person on YouTube pointed this out, is the hologram is very weird, and well, it's weird for many reasons, but it's very weird in that he's like moving his feet, and someone on YouTube would be like, this is clearly wrong. Roy Orbison stood completely still while playing and barely even swayed. And I looked at a bunch of like American Bandstand videos and stuff of Roy Orbison, and the person was totally right. Like, Roy Orbison doesn't move when he's playing. So why did they have him like dancing around and doing all these like weird maneuvers during the show, which he never actually did in person? It creates a scary idea in that we can make things that look very, if you saw this in person, maybe it doesn't look as convincing, but the video looks pretty convincing. We can make videos of people doing things that they wouldn't do at all look very convincing in real life, which is kind of scary. But this is just gruesome. You know, with Dio and like, well, with Dio, I had some sympathy for his wife because, you know, I mean, and also with like Motorhead, I think wasn't there a Holo Motorhead? They're still trying to make money. They're still trying to, you know, get their thing going. But Roy Orbison has been dead for about 32 years. So it's not a question of the family having no source of income. It's just a family willing to resurrect people in kind of a gruesome manner just to make a quick buck, if you ask me. This is ultimately empty, not worthwhile. And I'd rather just go see an orchestra do Roy Orbison's music than some gruesome facade of Roy Orbison underneath a light projector.
I agree. I wish we could stop doing this forever. There are some things like that we as kids kind of thought like would be in the future that would be really cool, and this hologram thing just doesn't seem to be working out. So if we can just kill this idea, that'd be great before it gets like actually insulting. I think I brought this up the last time we talked about one of these. How much could possibly people be paying for these tickets?
I think a lot, because I think now more than ever, people don't have a gauge as to what concerts cost. You know, like my boss just took his daughter to see, you know, some act, and tickets were like what punkers would call obscenely expensive, but to him and most people, that's what concert tickets cost. You know,
yeah, but at least you get the real person.
Well, I agree with you, but what I'm saying is more and more people are losing the concept of what it really costs to have a night out on the town, and more people are willing to blow a higher percentage of their income for a quote night out on the town, which is dangerous, if you ask me. I spent $100 to see the Misfits. You know what I mean? Who am I to talk?
Yeah, but you're not seeing holograms in the Misfits.
Well, no, I agree, but like some people spend $500 to see the Misfits. You know, the Misfits are not worth $500, but a lot of people spend it. You know.
Can we please stop doing this hologram thing? It's just annoying and kind of I not to sound elitist, I think this isn't really, I don't think it's in good taste at all.
No, why is that elitist? I agree with you. It's not in good taste, but why is that elitist?
Maybe just, I didn't want to sound condescending.
No, I think it's in terrible taste, especially since Warburton's been dead for a long time. So it's not like the family needs the money, you know?
I mean, can you imagine? I think, John, you and I talked about this too. But, I mean, the backlash, at least in the punk community, that would happen if the Clash got back together with Hologram Strummer. With Hologram Joe Strummer. What would happen? I mean, it wouldn't be good. So far we've had holograms of mainstream artists, but if that were to happen with the Clash, I think that'd be not.
Honestly, I think the Clash are so popular, it would still be profitable because people that aren't even if the Clash are punk, like most people, or at least a good percentage of people that are quote into punk aren't into punk as deep as punk news, and punk news isn't even as deep as it gets punk rock wise. You know, I think the Clash are popular enough that people would still go to see it. I could be wrong. I don't know.
I hope they don't do it. And this needs to end.
My opinion on the Holograms is the same as it's been whenever we've mentioned this, which is there is a missed opportunity to make this some sort of terrifying 30-foot Roy Orbison that like rages through the crowd. Like, it's a hologram, right? You don't have to adhere to scale. You could make him enormous or do something really fucking weird with it. But you know, no one has my creative spark, John.
Well, then you can try. If you can do it, you can charge $500 for it.
Adam, you might not remember this, but in the late 80s, there was this very short-lived fad where you could go to the movies and there would be like a button at the movies and you could click a button to make the movie end the way you want it, right? And the machine would tally it up and then the movie would end the way people clicked on the majority of people clicked on the button. What if like when you went to see Holo Roy, like you could make him like female, or maybe you make him like, I don't know, like a robot, you know, or you could get the Roy that the majority, or a Wolfman, you could get the Roy that the majority of the audience wants.
You see, that's what I'm talking about, right? So all of a sudden, like a little prompt appears on top of the hologram that's like, you know, continue in classic Roy or enter Wolfman mode, right? It's like press the blue button for Wolfman or the red for classic, and like everyone is furiously mashing the button to see what happens. And see, that's what should happen here. I don't know why they don't give me all their hologram money. I can make this happen.
So, Ad, you were saying they're not prostituting the memory of Roy enough. You're saying they could prostitute it even more.
I mean, if you're going to do one of these weird, surreal, gruesome things, you should really do it. Like, go back to, like, the Joe Strummer example, right? Like, I don't want to see hologram Joe Strummer, you know, playing on stage with, like, old man Paul Simonon. Like, that's not what I want. What I want is hologram Joe Strummer suddenly is in the middle of Times Square and people driving all over the place because they don't want to hit it because they're not sure if it's real or not. Like, that's what I want. I want these things to be agents of chaos. Fighter jets, John. He's swatting at fighter jets. That's what we should do. All right. I'm going to play one more song and then we're going to get out of here. This is a band called Chain Whip, which is a fucking great name. It's a bunch of guys from a bunch of you know, reasonably well-known bands in the kind of garage punk scene out of Vancouver got together to make sort of a fun throwback tough sound and early punk record. So on the vocals here is Josh Nickel, who plays guitar in Fashionism. It features Joel Butler, who's in Nervous Talk and the Corner Boys on guitar, Brett Thompson of Stress Eating on bass, and Patrick Bertrand of Hosehead Records. He runs that label. And he also drums in the Corner Boys and sings in the Corner Boys. He's on drums in here. So this band released a 5-song self-titled EP just a couple weeks ago, and it's going to be on a 7-inch at some point later in the year. So I'm going to play a song from it because it's super fun. Here's one called 6-Day Weekend. So this is 6-Day Weekend by Chain Whip out of Vancouver. What I want to say, I don't want to say. Yes, there's anything I want to say. Think I'm gonna crack, just can't relax. Chuck it in the can, but I get in a bit. Think I need a 6-Day Weekend. I'm here for a 6-Day Weekend.
And that was Chain Whip, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Any last words, any holo requests for you to see, or any exorbitant amount of money you would pay to see any particular band?
Well, if we can just stop, just forever stop this hologram thing, that'd be great.
It sounded like you were rifling through your papers to get your opinion.
There. That wasn't me.
Oh,
no, that wasn't me.
The effect was pretty good.
The band I would pay to see, do they have to be living?
Well, I mean, you can see the holo versions.
No. Okay. Fine. So
death
living
doesn't matter
living,
anymore.
I mean, I paid. I mean,
when I mean, you can see them, but they're not going to do much else except for lie there. You know, that's what you want.
I mean, I don't think the most I ever paid for a ticket to see a show was Kiss before I knew any better. And I was like 15. But I'd put a bill down to see Rage Against the Machine again.
Adam White. Who would you pay a lot of money to see, or who would you like to see in a holo form?
Wow. All right. So if I could if I could put down $500, right? And from my $500, the TARDIS materializes in front of me and I get to go back in time and see that, Screen on the Green show that had like the Sex Pistols with the Clash and the Buzzcocks opening for them, and it cost like £1 to go to that show. I'd go to that one, and then I would, you know, fight Cybermen or whatever else you do when you're in the TARDIS. But that, you know, that for that whole experience, that sounds like a pretty good deal.
What if Doctor Who decides to break his taboo and wants you to keep you on as a companion? But what do you do then, Adam?
I thought you were going to say, like, what if he breaks his taboo and decides to, like, fall in love with you? And
that's what I'm saying. See, Doctor Who's rule is that he never falls in love with his companion, but he does, like, every season.
I mean, if he brought me to that show, I'd probably have to just go along with it. Yeah. Yeah, I'm down with that.
There you go. We'll see you next week.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@valorundergroundstudios.com.